Good morning, everybody. Well, it's, you know, although my responsibilities have decreased, my interest in crops, especially crops in Illinois, has certainly not decreased. And I thought, well, you know, kind of wondered if it wouldn't have been better to be not retired this last year, because we're setting new yield records for both corn and soybeans in Illinois. And that's a pretty rare event, but one that we're always happy to have. And we're going to talk about a variety of things. I did go back, Dan, and look at last year. We used the same title, just with different years, which shows a certain lack of imagination, but it also shows you that 2 years were truly amazing, 2 years in a row. And really, the last 5 years have been pretty outstanding. And we'll talk about trends and some of these sorts of things as we get going here this morning. So soybean is a crop that, you know, it takes, you know, it's really gained in prominence during my lifetime. It's soybeans has gone from not a crop really in the Corn Belt to a major crop with more soybean acres now than corn for grain acres, at least. And that's really quite a development. I don't think 50 years ago anybody would have predicted that that's going to happen, but it's a testament to the improvement in the crop, in the genetics, in the management, in the weed control, and in all of the things that we do with this wonderful crop. And it's I've told this story a few times to international audiences about its rise as a world crop, and made the point that no other crop, I think, in the history of the world has basically become a major crop in less than 100 years like soybean has. It's a wonderful story. Here's the story brought down to Illinois level, and this is the corn and soybean acres over the last 20 years or so. I guess that's more than 20, more like 30. But you can see there what we've done with acres. You know, back in the late 90s, early 2000s, they were pretty similar acreage at levels about the same as they are today. And then we had the ethanol balloon, I guess we'll call it, that brought corn prices up sharply. And we had some good yields during the 2000s. And, you know, corn really became the golden crop in terms of profitability. Soybean was good, but you can see how the acres spread apart. So we were about 3 million acres difference between these two only back there 7, 8, 9 years ago. And today, the gap is pretty much closed. And in 2018, we had just about equal acreages. That doesn't necessarily mean that's going to stay there. The talk is, of course, what's going to happen with these two crops if soybean marketing gets back on track internationally, and our markets for both crops are pretty dependent on how much we can export and what the rest of the world will buy it for. And that's probably not going to stay that way necessarily, but having equal acreage of corn and soybean allows us to sort of rotate those two crops. And it's, as I've told you the story often before, it's good for both crops. And we'll show you a little bit of data later on things like continuous soybean. It's something that didn't look particularly good this last year, but with high yields everywhere, you know, a lot of people are going to say, well, you know, we might have been able to get 5 bushel more, but 80 is pretty good. So, and I want to emphasize too, as we talk about this, that not everybody enjoyed those yields. With our yield level set to be 64, at least that's the current estimate, you know, that means that half the acres were below that and half were above that, probably at least distributed that way. And so we don't want to get too carried away and say, everybody got high yields without trying this last year, because weather didn't cooperate in all places. But we'll talk about all of those things. Here are the trend lines for corn and soybeans over that same time period, 29 years. I don't know why I started with 90, but it does make a difference where you start. And basically knocking out 88, 89, which were low corn yields and not great soybean yields, sort of gets us on a little smoother route going forward. The corn one is pulled down by that 2012 yield, barely above 100. And but you can see here, if you look at the last, 2015 with its high rainfall in parts of Illinois got pulled down. But we've been on a pretty good run of above trend line yields in both crops. It's 4 out of the last 5 for corn, as you can see up here, and it's 5 out of the last 5 for soybean. And this is something where it's not that we've never seen anything like this before. You can go back and look and see that, corn back there 10 plus years ago was 4 years or so above trend line. But the trend line is obviously pulled up over time, and that means that, we come back towards that trend line, or the trend line comes up towards the yields one way or the other. And that will happen with both crops. But there's a lot of weight on the soybean ones if you look at it. The number I want you to look at here is up here on corn. It says yield is 2.42 and too many digits in there. But that means that over that time period, the increase has been 2.42 bushels per acre per year. Soybeans is 0.64 bushels per acre per year. The two lines look pretty different, of course, but on a percentage basis, they're not very much different. And our general rule of thumb is, soybean yields times 3 is good corn yields. Good soybean yields times 3 is good corn yields. And that trend line isn't quite there. It's a little bit more than 3. Times the difference, but it's in that vicinity. So that shows what our trends have been. And looking at these, and some of the economists here have written about this, that it almost looks like the soybean trend lines, particularly if you look at the U.S. when it's in the same direction. And they have suggested that there's a possibility that this line is actually curving upwards. An upward curving yield line is a magic thing. That we've mostly only dreamed about. And I don't want to get carried away with this, because 5 years above trend line, as you can see here, this is just soybeans now, and I've taken the corn out, so it expands the scale. And you can see what we're looking at here. But I thought, just to try it, I'd put that the trend line in as a straight line, and which is, we normally talk about trend line yields as straight line yields, and then I put it in as a curved line. So I did both. And you can get all fancy statistically and so on, but the R squared value, which shows basically how well that line fits the points, is higher for the curved line than it is for the straight line. And we get excited about that, but even with 5 years of above trend line yields, I want to be kind of cautious about that, realizing it only takes a couple years of trend line or below trend line yields to kind of knock the curve out of that line. So, but it's a pretty dramatic difference if you look at it now. And I just put these verbiage down here at the bottom. I said, if it's a straight line over the last 10 years, I had told you it's 0.64 bushels per year. So it's 6.4 bushel increase over the last 10 years. If we apply a curved line over the last 10 years, the difference between from 10 years ago to today with the curve is actually 13.5 bushel yield increase. That's what we call the predicted yield. So it's what the yield on this line is, even though you can see the line only hits some of the points directly, maybe 3 or so out of the last 20. But the actual yield difference between 2008 and 2018 is 17 bushels per acre. And so it is a dramatic difference. There's no question about it. These last 5 years have been a great run for soybeans. I'm not going to sit here and say next year, we'll have another point to add up here about 68 or 70. I don't know if that's going to happen. We certainly have the yield potential to do that. But as we saw this year, it takes everything weather-wise and management-wise, particularly weather-wise, takes everything going really right to get these really high yields. and not just right, but right pretty much everywhere in the state of Illinois if we're going to do that. I do look at these trends. This brings us back to earth a little bit, and I know almost all of you that deal with soybeans, grow corn, or deal with corn as well. And I don't want to look at this as a competition between the two crops, but if we consider this to be sort of a gauge of maybe genetic potential, looking at the corn and soybeans together. And so here we just take the yield ratio of corn yield divided by soybean yield in bushels. That's not a very fair thing because soybean bushels weigh more and have more energy. But in any case, if we look at them that way, then the lower these bars are, the better soybeans did relative to corn. And 2012 was the chief of among those years over the last 30, where we had the big drought effect on corn and less on soybeans because it started raining later in the season. Soybeans had more potential left at that point. Back to 2003, which was a prototype terrible soybean year, and a decent corn year. And so if you, those are the two extremes, but if you look at this line that I put through these bars, you can see that we're pretty much at the average, or what the trend line would suggest here for 2018, and that's down there at about 3.3 or so. So that's the corn yield divided by the soybean yield statewide in Illinois. And you can see it's been pretty consistent over the last 5 years, you know, bouncing between about 3.15 or so and a little over 3.5, and generally coming in these ranges. If we, depending on the year we have, you know, they're going to bounce around, but I'd say this paints a fairly stable picture. We don't have the, you know, much better corn than soybean yields now, or haven't had them recently like we did back in the 2000s. You can see 5 years of the 2000s, that bar was above 3.5, which says really much better corn yields than soybean yields in relative terms. So this doesn't tell a great, you know, this doesn't tell a simple story necessarily. It feels good that both of the crops are doing relatively well. And I think it confirms also that the same weather that helps one crop help another crop. We see a few exceptions like in 2012, where soybeans were more resilient to the dry pattern that we had in 2012 than corn was. Pod counts are something you can see. They release these... you can see them in the November crop estimates. I think that's the first time we see them, but they talk about them earlier on. So they're always taking pod counts to try to get guess at the yield potential. And the 2018 ones that I have here, both the yield, projected yield, and the pod counts are those from the November crop production report. The final, of course, comes out next month. And then we'll see those, but these pod counts don't tend to change a lot. And I showed you that opening picture with lots of pods on them because that's what I've learned is the one thing you look at back in August if you want to get an idea. Not how many flowers there are, not how tall the plants are, really not even how green they are, or how good the canopy is back there in late July, early August, but basically how many pods set. And we've been disappointed and we've been excited over recent years, but you can see pod numbers have been pretty high as we've had high yields. And everybody acknowledges, you know, sometimes the pod numbers weren't great for the yields that we got. So there's always that, but I'm sorry, I was showing the wrong ones. In 2017, we had a relatively low pod count for high yields that we got. So that either means another, you know, part of a bean per pod or slightly larger beans, and I suspect it was the latter last year. this just shows the correlation between those, and we don't want to get into too much detail on this, but this was an odd one out, this one way back at low pods and low pod counts and low yields. But if here's 2018, just to show you that it's a little bit off the chart in this regard in having the high pod counts. And high pod counts, as I put it in one of my articles, was just, you know, pods all over the place this last year. Oh, we got our eyes were, you know, a little bit larger than reality in some cases, and we thought these were going to yield 100 plus. One farmer over in the south of Springfield told me that he had a field that went 105. We've certainly heard of quite a few fields in the 90s, and I can pretty much guarantee you that none of those fields had low pod numbers. There were lots of pods. So do a calculation before we move on. In 2018, if we assume 2.5 beans per pod, which is a pretty decent assumption, and 2,700 beans per pound, which is pretty average, there were about 32 pods per plant and about 80 seeds per plant. And 32 pods, as you see pictures of, you know, people always take pictures when they get 80 pods per plant, and we get this impression that every plant, you know, is just loaded top to bottom. And if you really get realistic and objective about it, that's not going to happen. You know, some plants always down the row will not have very many. Some have more than that. It's highly variable. And one of the reasons that yield estimates in soybeans are always a little bit marginal, and at least unless you take lots more plants than most people want to take, it's why we can get a little bit misled by them. But it's still, you know, we had extra good stands this last year, and that tends to, high stands tend to lower pod counts and probably per plant, and that makes sense, but probably also, I guess I didn't put on here what the assumption of the number of plants was. I think I used 120,000 for this. But the pod counts, are they not only become lower if you have high plant counts, but they also become somewhat more variable. And you start to pick up more plants that only have, you've seen runt plants or spindly plants that have two or three or no pods in some cases. They're not weeds in terms of their presence actually lowered the yield, but they don't contribute. Not all plants contribute, and we always see some of that. This is a nice summation you can get off of the NASS Ag Statistics Service website as well, by state and by crop. And I cut out the middle graph that appears on the page, but the top one shows you the crop ratings for the year. And basically they started high in 2018 and they never really dropped to speak of. So this was, you know, above 80% is certainly high. They've kind of edged down for a while and were a little bit lower, and then they started to come back up again. And these are kind of subjective a little bit. I mean, maybe a lot subjective. They're basically, I think, more of a sort of drive-by and how does that crop look. And so the bounces you tend to see in July and August have to do with, you know, how much did it just rain and how much is it supposed to rain and how hot is it and how do I feel today and some of that kind of thing. But this also illustrates, I put the yields out here, to that the crop ratings don't always tell the true story. And certainly in 2017 and 2015, you know, these were pretty low ratings in both of those years, especially 2015 for the yields we ended up getting then, which was 56 in 2015 and 58 in 2017. So they can only take us so far, and we've had, back over the years, we've had some pretty good ratings without the greatest yields ever as well. So down here at the bottom is one that I particularly like as a summary of how the season went. And most of you lived through it, so you kind of have an idea, but this is it in numbers. This is what NASS reports each Monday. from the day before Sunday, so it's a 1 week reporting interval, and all of us know that planting started really slowly this year. You can see there in the month of April, we only got planted, I think it was about 12% or something like that of the crop in the whole month. And then it just took off like a shot, and we started late. April was a terrible month for getting anything done. We didn't plant a whole lot of corn. We did get started the last week of April, both corn and soybeans. But then fortunately things broke, and April was more characterized by how cool it was rather than how wet it was, but the two go together because cool weather doesn't dry things up. And so you can see what happened here. Once it did dry up and warm up, we were off to the races in terms of getting this crop planted. And if you look at the average of the last 5 years, you know, we get into June to plant the last 20% of our crop, and that certainly didn't happen this last year. We were over 90% planted by the end of May. So it was a good planting progress under pretty good conditions. Emergence was early. Stands were wonderful. And then everything during the season was actually ahead of normal. And that's the important part. I've pointed this out to you before, that this difference between setting pods might be a little bit more consistent than blooming, because we had blooming, and I'll return to this. We had a lot of soybeans flowering beginning in mid-June. And that's pretty unusual. In other words, they started flowering before the longest day, and I'll come back to that, talk a little bit about that, more about that. And then losing their color and dropping leaves, you can see those were ahead of normal, but it's the distance between blooming and losing their color that's the thing we pay attention to. And this was just as great, if not greater, than it's normally been. So everything was ahead of normal by about 2 weeks, except harvest. And you know what we had with some wet weather during harvest. And I saw a field not too far from here the other day that isn't harvested yet. Not quite sure. That one might be, you know, they may not have wanted the income this year or something, but there probably are a few scattered fields that we still see where it got wet and it still stayed wet. I think the beans are still in the pod, so we can probably get those still. This is rainfall statewide. This is if we see numbers like this, we see, boy, that was a really good year, you know, at or above normal rainfall, or close to normal rainfall, and in every month of the growing season, and June a little bit ahead. Fortunately, it wasn't very evenly distributed, and I'll show you a couple of maps here just to make the point. This color is 50 to 75% of normal for the month of July, and you can see this stretch across northern and a little bit of southern Illinois. But most of the state was in pretty good shape, some of, even a little bit wet, but there was a chunk up here that wasn't. And then if we move to August, some of that drier time during August, and we were better shape than in July, but the unfortunately sort of the same area got hit by that and over into western Illinois. So certainly those of you who are located in that area know that that this, you know, the crop couldn't sustain its full growth and seed filling rate progress during those time periods. In fact, we did have a chunk of Illinois show up on the drought map. The yellow just is abnormally dry, so it's not something that's severe, but if it's prolonged, it will reduce yields. And then this color is, this is the color that's the, shows the drought. So there was a little pocket in northeastern Illinois and over in western Illinois, and then over along the river, at Mississippi River in western Illinois, it was even a little bit greater than that. These are the areas, and we don't get reports from NASS by crop reporting district, but it's those regions that you see there, particularly the northeastern Illinois one, which persisted for quite a while during the summer, is going to be where we'll see some lower yields. Temperatures were not really too far off normally, with one great exception, and that was the month of May. We were about 8 degrees above normal for the month of May. I don't think I've ever seen that before. And because the crop was getting planted in early May, it got the crop off to a great start. Otherwise, you know, those are pretty normal. Normal is really, you know, average rainfall and temperatures in Illinois are a formula for really good yields. They were that for big chunks of the state this last year. Sunshine, and Dan, you had asked about this earlier. This, I've shown you the last couple of years, these sunshine records. This is, I moved them from Champaign, which is just up north of where I'm sitting, to Bonneville, just west of town, because it's a little more open out there. And you can see 2016 and 2017, we had very high amounts of sunshine. They weren't record setting in 2018. The one I don't have on here is the month of May. And as I said, I think it's about, would probably be above normal, but it's less than the month of June. They were just good. And if you look at May, June, and July compared to, June, July, and August compared to some of these previous years, you know, 2015 was our swampy year, and we suffered quite a bit then. 16 and 17 were high sunshine, particularly 2017. And so 2018 just sort of falls in there. Certainly enough sunshine to make good yields. I keep September on there, but essentially 2018, this crop was pretty much done by early September. At least it had its potential completely set by then in most fields, and it wasn't very relevant in 2018. This is just a summary of that, and we'll need to keep moving here, but I already talked about the weather, you know, and what that did. The crop, and we'll talk more about it, but it began a little late with planting and finished earlier than normal. Excellent emergence and early growth and high crop ratings from the start. Flowering was much ahead of normal, with more than 40% of the crop flowering by July 1st. I don't think we've ever had that much of it flowering before that early. Excellent canopy color throughout pod setting and seed filling, and pod setting and maturity, both about 2 weeks ahead of normal. And a projected yield of 64, beating the previous Illinois record set in 2016 of 59 by 5 bushel. That's a nice jump. Yields some to well above normal in most areas, limited by dryness and drought in northeastern and western Illinois, and by high rainfall in parts of northwestern Illinois. I didn't really dwell on that. We were much better off than the states to the west and north of us in terms of getting too much rain. We didn't have a large area of that, at least in Illinois. And 2018, my final note there was that for the soybean crop was probably the most stress-free year that we've ever had across most of Illinois. Don't soybeans need short days to flower? I returned to that as a kind of an interest thing, and I said here, yes, nights need to be long enough. It's the night length that counts to trigger plants of a given maturity to flower. Later maturing varieties need a longer night, which corresponds to a shorter day than early ones, so we'll flower later. But if a variety normally gets a long enough night on July 10th, which is 20 days after the longest day or shortest night of the year, that same night length also occurs about 20 days before the longest day, or about June the 10th. And if plants have reached the V3 or so, three-leaf stage, by the time they get the signal to flower with a long enough night, they will flower even if it's before June 20. And those of you who've looked at production south of here, you know down in Arkansas, Tennessee, Louisiana, you know they're using early maturing varieties and trying to plant them in March or even February if they can, but certainly in March. And those essentially complete their flowering process before the longest day of the year, and they harvest them often in late July. So it doesn't. The days don't need to be getting longer by late I mean, they don't need to be getting shorter for the flower plants to flower. Once they get one night, that's long enough to send the signal to flower, they will flower if they're large enough. Night temperature is a much more important factor than most people think it is. And that was certainly the case in 2018. It takes a shorter night to trigger flowering if the night is warmer. And if we had had night temperatures during much of the month of June, sort of at their normal levels, 60-ish, we wouldn't have flowered nearly to the extent we did. Because the nights have to be long enough and warm enough, both, for that chemical conversion to take place that makes them flower. So just a little, and I show you an example here. We have a planting date study. I'll show you the results of this in a little bit, but we had maturity group 2.3 up to, I think there was one longer than this, but I just chose the 2.3 and 3.6 maturity groups here at Urbana. And these were planted April 26th, and then I chose the May 24th planting to compare it to. And you can see we had first flower with these early maturing ones on the 9th of June. And on the later maturing ones, it came in at about the 13th or 14th of June. If we planted them later, then the maturity group 2.3, you know, it started flowering about the 13th or 14th of June. And the 3.6 then was almost a month later. It didn't flower until 1st of July. And then I had first pod, start of pod fill, and maturity. And you can just sort of see that those are kind of in the same pattern. So the early maturing one, you know, it got even planted on May 24th. It got a signal to flower before the longest day of the year and was actually able to start flowering. So this is for you to ponder a little bit more. That's what I always tell the classes. It's not, you know, it's so critically important on its own, but it is kind of nice to be able to see it in action, how it works out. I'm just going to go from that and looking at maturity in the variety trials. I do this just to show you how the variety trials did and also to, you know, as something that's often of interest. And it's of interest primarily because it differs so much from one of our regions to another and from year to year. And this is one example where the later maturing varieties, you know, adding maturity actually added yield in this case. And this was in the northern region of Illinois, so above I-80. And you can see we added about 0.4 of a bushel per day. And a day is about a tenth of a maturity group. So going from a group 3 to our group 2.5 to 3.5 or 2.4 to 3.4 here added about 4.5 bushel. This is, I looked also at protein. I saw a comment recently where farmers were urged to use protein to help select their varieties so they could get the best quality out of them. We do protein and oil testing. If you haven't been to the variety testing website, just Google that and you can get to it at the U of I here. And we have protein and oil listed for each region. We take it at every site, and the Soybean Association supports that testing program. We've been doing it for many years now. Here's an odd one out here. I don't know what happened to that one, where that one came from. But you can see that for the most of these, you know, these protein levels were in there at around 34, 35, and they really did not change by variety to speak of. You know, ideally, if these things were positively correlated, high yields at high protein, then we could select for high protein or high yields and sort of end up with the same group of varieties. But when it's flat like this, it means that obviously, yield is an important thing to select on, but it's not going to change proteins very much, depending on what you select. This is the second region. This is down a little bit, so it runs along south of I-80 in north central Illinois, and you can see they're pretty much that same correlation. Again, very high yield levels. These are three location averages here where we're getting up in the 90s. And again, we added about 0.4 of a bushel for each day later in maturity. Now it's, you know, I don't, it's always a little, I do a little hand waving on this because we're, you know, varietal maturity is only one thing. And I tend to point out that within any sort of maturity here, you find a range of varieties, probably 10 bushel difference from top to bottom. It's more important to look at performance of these than it is at maturity. Here's, I did the same thing with protein on those and saw pretty much the same thing. These are actually low protein, relatively speaking. As you can see here, most of them are under 35%. And Seth Nave up at Minnesota, he works for the, he's my counterpart in soybean extension there, but he also pays a lot of attention to protein. And he had pointed out to us a couple months ago that there was a band across that where these trials are that, that shows fairly low protein. And so we don't know why that would be. This is, a lot of these are the same varieties you saw in the previous one, probably with 2 points lower protein. And it's a little bit of a concern. Companies pay attention to protein, particularly to not have proteins below, is their main interest. And I think they're successful with that for the most part. This is the third region, the one through central Illinois, includes the location here at Urbana. We had no effective maturity on yield at all in these, ranging from 2.7 to 4.3. I did look at Liberty Link versus the Roundup Extend, Roundup Ready soybeans, and the Liberty Link variety averaged about 1.8 bushels less than the RX varieties. They're identified that way in the variety trial report now. That's not a big shocking finding. Again, companies don't put these in with the idea that, you know, they have to compete in there as the group, but it just shows you, you know, there's not a big spread of yield potential between those two sets of varieties today. And proteins were actually a little negatively correlated with yield level in this central Illinois region. That's not very strong, but you know, losing a point on average, this line goes from 35 to about 34 as we go from the lowest yields to the highest yields in the trial. And this is region 5, way in southern Illinois, two sites in that region, and there was no effective maturity on yield there either. Doing the same in comparison, Liberty Link with the Extend soybeans down there, you can see it was a bigger difference, 3 bushel difference. Again, I'm not going to attach a huge amount of importance to that, but I think, and the shift, I will tell you here in a minute, the shift to the Extend beans is continued this last year in the variety trials. Now that you know, the Liberty Link are going with Credenz, and, you know, things are still changing in that. We don't know how this is all going to play out over the next year or two. So these are just notes, and I want to move on here. The effect of maturity, you know, our yields were high just like they are in farmers' fields. We had one site that averaged 89.3, which is, I think, a new variety trial record of a single site. And maturity on yield effect varied by region, range from positive to flat, with later maturity yielding more to no difference. And the Roundup Ready Extend soybeans increased again as percentage of enter varieties, mostly at the expense of the straight Roundup Ready without the Extend trait. And those appear to be kind of disappearing from the trial. There are some regional differences. Yields of the two groups differed more within group than between groups. And that's the other point I wanted to make So wrote this note here that looking within, say, Liberty Link or Extend is more important than looking between them. And that's what I encourage you to do. Selecting varieties based on protein content does, at least not at this point, appear to be a path to higher profits. We still need to have yield because for the most part, that's what we're getting paid for. Let's move on and talk about some of the agronomics. Planting date was an issue, of course, although not much of an issue, because as I said here, very few of these, there was very little late planting in 2018. This is a pretty typical yield response. Monmouth was in that dry area I showed you. It didn't have the highest yields there. They were just basically good for the most part in the 70s. And you can see that if anybody had late planting, it probably cost them pretty good yield. I took those data and spread them apart, those trials, as I have for a number of years. So this is the last one left. And, you know, most of this work that I've done over the years is, of course, winding down on soybean management. But we had 15 versus 30s in that trial, and the 15s did a little bit better. But not hugely better. And that's partly because if you look here, this is the 30s with no fungicide here. The two lower curves up there at the left-hand side. But for some odd reason, the 30-inch rows responded much more to fungicide at the late planting. I've seen so many of these over the years, I can't even, you know, so many differences in that. It's really hard to explain. Why would 30-inch rows with fungicide, you know, yield 5 bushel more than 15-inch rows with fungicide? I have no idea. We'll just have to leave it as a mystery and say that these results are typical in their inconsistency. We had that variety trial, I showed you some of the data earlier. We had maturity group 2.3 to 3.6 with one of the companies, and they sponsored this test we did this last year. We planted them at a very straight line downward trend in yield, starting at about 90 bushel per acre here at Urbana, planted about the 26th of April was the first we could plant, and we planted up to into early June. And you can see they're straight up, straight line down. If you ever needed encouragement to plant early, I guess this is some of it. Although I expanded the scale here to make it look scarier than it really was. We still got 60 bushel planting in early June, which we'd normally consider to be pretty good. What's interesting here is how the different maturity groups responded. So this is the 2.3 here. And you can see it was about it was more than 10 bushel lower. If at the earliest planting, and by the latest planting, it was sort of right in there with the rest of them. It's the only one that really deviated very much from this kind of straight line decline. So we'll just leave it at that. We've generally said from Jake Vossenkemper's work and some of the other work that's been done recently that the fuller season ones ought to be planted early. I guess that's true, but this year, this time the fuller season ones were, you know, they were 2.6 and above, which is hardly full season. And it was only this really early one that couldn't bring its yields up there with the earliest planting. I don't really know the answer for that. I showed you that this one started flowering in early June, and it just kept flowering. So I don't know if it's got restricted by just how much growth it made and how many pods it set there early. This is my curve that I've showed you before in soybean yields over years and over locations. And the points here are, we can start, you know, April 10th or so. We never had really yield reductions. Anytime we planted in April, we got at least as high a yield as planting anytime later. That means that there's no danger planting in mid-April, or maybe even a little bit earlier if we have good conditions. And then the yields start to decline after that. And on average, you know, we're only losing about 10% or 20% of our yield if we get back to into early June. That'd be the first week of June, right in this area here. We're still not losing yield at a very rapid pace there. And of course, we plant when we can, so we all know that. But planting date was delayed. Planting was sort of a non-issue in most areas. Double crop soybean yields were good. They picked up good weather, and the report I have at least is that wheat yields weren't great this year, but double crop was very good. And it got planted early, as you can guess, with the very warm temperatures bringing the wheat crop on early. With growing conditions uniformly good in most areas, there is little to threaten yields, but early planting still set the stage for higher yields. And the, once again, there was some super early, as in March 2018 planting. It was kind of a disaster. That may not be what gets reported this winter, but much of that had to be replanted. And we heard of at least one farmer that planted some pretty major acreages back in March. And with the snowfall and freezing temperatures in April, that was just too much for that crop. I got to speed up here. Seeding rate, I showed you these in 2016, 2017, and here are the 2018 results. Didn't spread these out as much as I should have. But you can see that in 2018, we tended to need a little bit more of tended to need more plants to optimize our yield. By optimize, I mean that they just paid for the seed at that rate. And when you put these all together from these last four, this was the 2015 to 17, and this is what I showed you a year ago. And after adding in the 2018 data, we kind of have to spread that circle to include them all. The average of these then is 123,000 plants. If you look at the ones within the circle, I left out these, and I left out these super high ones. But I'll just say that, you know, we needed 175,000 plants or more at four out of these locations, over 27 locations. So it's not impossible. And this would take 154,000 seeds at 80% emergence. So that just sums up what I said. A safe seeding rate is still in the 140,000 to 150,000 range when we include the 2018 results, but the risk of being, the risk of being too low to maximize returns to seed may be higher than the risk of being too high. And just think about that. I'm not pushing for higher seeding rates. I am pushing against the trend I've seen in some cases where people say, oh, if you get 100,000 plants, you got plenty. We do not find that to be the case. I think I'll skip over all of this. Our time is pretty much up. Just to say that in rotation study this last year, the one we have still running at Monmouth, continuous soybean did not do well. And this was about 20 years of continuous soybean. And they did not do very well. Our corn soybean rotated there yielded only 52 or so. These weren't great yields, as I said to you earlier at this site, but the ones with the 3-year rotations yielded better than the ones with just corn soybean. And I'll skip that and that. And we ran a study this last year here in 2018 at Urbana, where we had had continuous corn with residue removal and tillage in place for 12 years before. And kind of interesting results where we got higher yields where we had not removed residue than where we had removed some or all of the residue over all 12 of those years. And no-till yielded more than tilled in this case. Again, we'll just have to ponder that, and I'll skip that one. And I'll skip that one and end up and get us to the end here. So about nitrogen, when the canopy is dark green by early August, as I say here, the crop is unlikely to yield more if N fertilizer is used. By August 1 in 2018, it was very dark green, almost every field. This is some nice work, and some of you have seen me show this from Wisconsin, where they looked at nitrogen uptake. And what their point is that, you know, here by R4, R5, the crop should have taken up about 50% of its nitrogen. These were high yielding soybeans, 80 some bushel. You can see here, they took up over 300 pounds total. And this gets translocated then to the seed, what's in the plant there at the stage R4, R5. And that's important that they have a lot of nitrogen in them then. If they do, they'll look dark green, and they're going to have plenty of nitrogen to get through to the end of the season. Our results with nitrogen, I've showed you these before. They're still, and we're pretty much stopped this work now. You can strong arm a 5 bushel out of the yield, if you put on 100 pounds 2 or 4 times, but it's not economical. And in many cases, putting on more during the season doesn't increase the yields at all, as we've seen the last 2 years. So just a recap and last slide, less stressed soybeans encounter, the more they tend to yield. That's sort of sounds reasonable. My point here is don't create stress on purpose. As some people have said, soybeans love stress. If you stop it, they're so happy they yield more. Doesn't seem to work. Variety maturity is not too strongly correlated with yield potential, but I would suggest choosing from among not the earliest varieties. And planting early from mid-April, not mid-March, into mid-May produces the highest yields. And for reasons not altogether clear, we needed more plants in 2018 to maximize return to seed. 140 to 150,000 is still safe, but don't skimp. Most yields with high and higher yields in 2018 did not receive fertilizer N, and that's going to be true in 2019 as well. And I didn't talk a lot about this. I'll let the others carry on with this, but still little consistent benefit to fungicide or insecticide when diseases and insects aren't present. And we'll stop with that. Took up all of my time plus, again, as usual, and appreciate your attention.
All right, Emerson, thank you very much. You covered a lot of ground there in 1 hour. Got some questions here. Have you done any work yet with Nemastrike and its ability to control SCN in soybeans?
I have not. I've noticed what the ads are now saying, that it seems like Alevo is a nematode control now too. I'll have to leave those to Nathan Kluszewski. I'm sure he's going to be talking about it over the winter, or just contact him directly.
Okay. Are the K needs by soybeans expanding, and should we be increasing the application rate?
Of potassium?
Yeah, potassium.
No, they haven't been increasing. I wrote an article on fall fertilization a couple of months ago. You might want to look at that, where we talked about with the new numbers, the removal numbers we have or our grain content of actually a little bit lower than the ones that were in the book. And we continue to not really see K deficiency symptoms and continue not to see much response to adding K to soybeans if our soil test levels are adequate. The point was that I was making in the article was that with these high levels of yield that we've been taking off, we are removing a lot of K, and at some point we need to replace it.
Okay. Besides rainfall amounts and storm damage, what are the other most significant impacts of climate change on soybeans?
Well, it's hard to say, because climate change is going to be a more of a generally observed phenomenon, and the effects of weather on soybeans are pretty period specific. And Yeah, I think our soybean crop, the genetics have brought it to a state where it's going to generally do better no matter what weather it gets. But we're all a long ways from having this be, you know, bulletproof. And it's hard to say. If we saw this year that temperatures during the middle part of the summer were pretty typical, pretty normal, and I think that was favorable for the crop. But we've seen in recent years above normal and below normal in August, and they don't seem to really mind that much if they're set up for a high yield potential by the time we get there. It's a complicated thing, and you know, it's the weather throughout the season, not just during any period of time, but that does sets us up for good yields and can also set us up for disappointment.
A lot of good questions here, Evans. I don't look at time. Lower test rate in soybeans this year. What's up?
That certainly is the case, and I probably should have put something in. Some of it was disease. We had deteriorated soybeans, and some of them really looked pretty bad by the time they got harvested. That might have been part of it. It's unusual to hear about dockage on soybeans. We did hear some this year, and that some of it was docked. Honestly, I do not know why soybeans that were in areas, you know, yielding 75, 80, 90 bushel, I don't know why those would have had lower than normal test weights. Our combine can take them in the variety trials. We just don't even bother with the data because it's never very much interest. And we could speculate and wave our hands and say, well, you know, it all came, yield got built pretty fast and it didn't pack it into the seeds enough or this sort of thing. But soybean seeds are round and they fit together pretty well. And you have to have big change in sort of grain density and within a current individual seed to affect the test weight much. And I don't know what the answer, why that would have been the case in 2018.
A couple questions. One on height. You know, soybean height, you got tall soybeans that lodge over and cause harvesting difficulties. As we look at height, is that any relationship to yield in Illinois?
It's a good question. We've looked at it. In our variety trials, we still take height, and we do it partly so we can look at things like that. It was pretty typical this last year. We had the early growth, but it didn't, you know, keep wet, warm and wet there in about late July is what makes them keep extending their height, and we didn't really see them do that this year. We think that there's an optimal sort of an ideal height, and if they're too much taller or too much shorter, it means yield loss. And if I had to give you a number today, I'd say probably 36 inches to the tip of the stem. But, you know, the lodging, the type of lodging that we saw, and that's not always coming with tall beans, but we saw favorable, I'm going to call it favorable leaning. This year, we saw fields, and all of you saw this there in August, as their pods got heavier, they just kind of, you know, started to sink towards the ground a little bit. When the leaves fell off, they kind of straightened back up. And these are generally a favorable indication, just that the pods were filling. There were lots of pods and they were filling well. Obviously, the company's breeders are selecting against lodging tendencies. I think that there's a general acknowledgement, you know, if we have conditions that result in really short plants, it's often ones that result in lower pod numbers per plant as well. Although short soybeans can yield very well in many cases, getting them too tall, it's not like, you know, it's never seems to be an increaser of yield if you can have conditions that get soybeans too tall. And in years like 2003, when they all got really tall and lots of growth, we do so much internal shading in those that we often can't fill the pods completely.
Right. Well, I had another question here about this whole thing about population, because you had said that there seemed to be, didn't have enough plants out there. And don't skimp on population. It seemed like you'd recommend 140 to 150. Planting, I found that kind of interesting. that we're kind of short on population. Where on that today?
Well, this last year, and I've not very many fields were short on population because our stand percentages were so good this year. I think they were 95% in a lot of fields, or even better than that. And so we had probably enough plants in virtually every field. What surprised me was that we had these sites again this year where we needed 170,000 or more plants to get to maximum yield. And we've sort of thought over recent years that we never need to do that. And with good pod numbers per plant, we would have thought, well, the pod, you know, if there's fewer plants, they'll just have more pods on them. And there might have been a limitation of some sort in there when we had too many plants or didn't have enough plants so that they could compensate. I want to say this correctly. We had good plant counts, but it might not have been quite enough to maximize the number of pods per acre or per square foot. I don't think we saw it such a big shift from what we've seen before that we should make any changes in what we're doing, unless we've been trying to get by with, you know, dropping 120,000 or so, and that might be time to rethink that a little bit.
Right. Okay, hey, Emerson, we kind of ran out of time. We got one last question. I don't really expect you to answer it. Let somebody ask, did the Trump payment bring about an increase in soybean yield this year?
You were breaking up there, Dan. What did you say?
No, I said somebody asked, did the Trump payment, commodity payment, bring about an increase in soybean yields this fall? So,
it's a little bit too late to have very much of that.
Yeah. All right. Well, Emerson, again, thank you very much for taking your time to give us another webinar. We hope you're still actively working. You can come back next year and give us another great update on the 2019 soybean crop.